Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. Syrian State Television is reporting this Sunday that a suicide bomber in a car blew himself up in central Damascus, killing at least 8 people, wounding about a dozen others. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights put the death toll at 12. Syrian security forces said they prevented 2 other would-be bombers from doing any damage. Gunfire signals the Iraqi federal police troops are pushing deeper into Mosul's old city Sunday as they try to recapture more positions from the Islamic State group. The area is a densely populated neighborhood west of the Tigris River, where militants are now making their last stand in what are expected to be the final days of the battle for Iraq's second largest city. Authorities say a fire erupted at a Syrian refugee camp on the Lebanese border Sunday, killing at least 1 person. Around 100 tents were destroyed in the fire about an hour outside Beirut. More than 1 million registered Syrian refugees live in Lebanon, largely in settlements in the Bekaa area near the country's border. French President Emmanuel Macron says West Africa and France must work together to eradicate terrorism. Speaking in Mali at the opening of a summit on forming a regional anti-jihadist force, Macron pledged military support, including tactical vehicles, to fight terrorists in the region. Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mauritania, and Niger have said they are coming together to provide troops to combat rising insecurity and jihadist attacks affecting their countries. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The Red Cross is warning the humanitarian situation in South Sudan remains catastrophic, even though the famine has ended. Lisa Schlein reports from the Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
The South Sudanese government and the United Nations declared on June 21st that the famine that had struck parts of Unity State is over. The International Red Cross Federation warns, however, against complacency. The head of the agency's office in South Sudan, Michael Charles, says the situation remains precarious, although famine conditions are no longer present.
We have over 1.7 million people that are at the brink of famine. And really, you know, the lifting of the famine vis-a-vis the emergency phase of food insecurity is very blurry in the eyes of the people that are affected.
Charles says efforts by aid agencies have managed to lift South Sudan out of famine, but he warns that another man-made disaster brought on by conflict could occur if peace efforts make no progress. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization says a rapidly spreading cholera outbreak in Yemen has claimed 1,500 lives since April and is suspected of affecting 246,000 other people. Dr. Sharon Varkey is the UNICEF deputy representative in Yemen.
Every single minute, one new child is reporting sick with acute watery diarrhea. Unfortunately, some of these children will not live to see the light of the next day.
The WHO said that a quarter of those killed by cholera in the war-torn country were children. Brazilian police, that is, say they have arrested an infamous drug kingpin who had evaded authorities for 3 decades. Authorities say Luis Carlos de Rocha had undergone plastic surgery in his efforts to dodge capture. Officials believe de Rocha is the head of a massive international cocaine empire. Samsung Electronics said Sunday it will start selling refurbished versions of the Galaxy Note 7 smartphone this week in South Korea. The Note 7 was recalled last year because its batteries would overheat and catch fire. The refurbished versions will use different batteries. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is back home in Tel Aviv Sunday, not long after being released from prison. After the parole board granted him an early release from his 27-month sentence for corruption. The 71-year-old Olmert did not speak to reporters after leaving the prison. For more news, please join us at our website, that is voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
If there is anyone who is encouraging president or even thinking that the president should step down at this time, that person is trying to drive South Sudan into hell. If it is not a spiritual hell, then it is political hell.
A South Sudanese government presidential spokesman denies media reports of pressure to force President Salva Kiir to step down.
Because we want the change and we want it now, and the politicians don't seem to help us. So I decided to mobilize the people and we make use of the democracy that we have.
A popular Ugandan musician wins a parliamentary by-election with a huge landslide victory.
This, I don't know how, but unfortunate day, while she was on the air on national television, I mean, a collaborator brought in a script, into her hand.
And a Cameroonian journalist is punished for broadcasting fake news on national television. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has denied local media reports that leaders of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, or SPLM, are putting pressure on the country's leader to step down and hand over power. The report said the SPLM leaders say the president is to blame for the country's conflict and the ongoing political crisis. The conflict has so far left tens of thousands dead and over 2 million displaced from their homes. But presidential spokesman Atenyuek Ateny told me that the reports are a calculated ploy aimed to embarrass the president.
I think this is a fabricated lie. Who should be encouraging President Salva Kiir at this moment to step down? If there is anyone who is encouraging president or even thinking that the president should step down at this time, that person is trying to drive South Sudan into hell. If it is not a spiritual hell, then it is political hell. Because President Salva Kiir is not a quitter. The President Salva Kiir is determined to ensure he returns the country to normalcy and then avail the opportunity for the people of South Sudan. He cannot step down to leave the leadership in a vacuum.
The report says that, you know, the president is being encouraged to step down because he has failed the nation. You just said that he is trying to return the country to normalcy. That means there is an inherent problem that he has failed to resolve, they said.
The president is a leader of the nation. It is the resilience and the ability of Salva Kiir leadership that managed to bring South Sudan into a referendum and subsequently into independence. Anybody who describe President Salva Kiir as a failure, that person might not look into the real thing, and that person would be actually dreaming, simply because if there is anybody in this well who has succeeded to sail the country to the shore of liberation or the shore of freedom in a very, very complicated situation is Salva Kiir.
The report is saying calling on him to step down is the reason why President Salva Kiir is not attending the Heads of State and Government Summit in Addis Ababa beginning Monday.
No, that's not true. President Salva Kiir delegated his first vice president on the basis, the doctrine of delegation of powers. Any president in the world, if he's engaged at home, as the president wanted to pay a courtesy visit to the national dialogue, he did not want to travel because he will be actually listening to the leadership of the national dialogue, which is now a priority in the nation to bring the country into normalcy. And therefore, the president was engaged because the solution of South Sudan problem will not come from Addis Ababa, will not come from anywhere. It will come from inside South Sudan.
Well, you said President Salva Kiir led South Sudan to independence. There was so much goodwill. People wanted South Sudan to succeed. There was the international community support to help build infrastructure and improve the living conditions of the people. The goodwill that the country has, critics say he has squandered it. That is why they said he has failed, because the country currently is embroiled in a conflict. You have hundreds of thousands of people who have been killed. Over 2.4 million people have been displaced out of their homes to neighboring countries, including Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and the rest.
First of all, I don't want to justify why our people are leaving the country, but the situation is not peculiar to South Sudan. Even those who are actually drowning while trying to go into Italy or Europe, trying to risk their life, you know, climbing high seas, are not from South Sudan. You know, President Salva Kiir did a lot, but he is let down by international community. I'm so sorry to say this, simply because when he led South Sudan into independence, the euphoria and the expectation of the people of South Sudan was to see South Sudan a country that deserved for all of us to live in. But when the country was born, it was born incapacitated, simply because the United Nations decided to send a mission, a protection force. So it is like South Sudan was born accompanied by someone, you know, on the premises that South Sudan was fragile. And the international community work on the fragility of that thing. They have been talking about corruption. When President Salva Kiir took a zero tolerance on corruption and decided to account those who have looted the country and sacked the government in order for him to account, he was blamed by the same people who are telling him that you have to account those who have corrupted. So if President Salva Kiir was to be allowed to account these people, if the international community was genuine, to see into it that there is no corruption in South Sudan, South Sudan would have been a free from corruption country.
Attorney Wekatene is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. A popular Ugandan Afrobeat musician has won a by-election to represent a constituency in central Uganda. Robert Sentamu, who is popularly known by his stage name Bobby Wine, won by a huge landslide by defeating candidates from the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, and main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. The Electoral Commission declared Bobby Wine winner of the vote with 77% of the total vote cast. To find out why he decided to compete for a parliamentary seat, I reached Bobby Wine in Kasangati, a suburb of the Ugandan capital Kampala, and began by asking what prompted him to go into politics.
Because we want a change and we want it now, and the politicians don't seem to help us. So I decided to mobilize the people and we make use of the democracy that we have. So we took matters into our own hands as the people.
What do you think made people vote for you? Is it because you are a popular musician?
Many people are popular. Even the politicians are popular and they are rich. People voted for me because my campaign was issue-based. Because I'm talking about the issues and I'm suggesting solutions. Because it's realistic and because it's not segregative. Because I'm not representing politicians or political parties, but I'm representing the interests of the people, the hopes that we hold together as Ugandans.
What specific issues were you addressing? What were the issues that you were crafting solutions to resolve to represent your people?
The first issue was the division. I wanted people to come together. I wanted us to stop looking at politicians for solutions, but to start looking at ourselves. I wanted our people to know that they are being taken for a ride, that they are fooled by the politicians. Because the politicians only get richer as our country is rotting, as the schools are getting worse, as the hospitals are getting worse. The parliament is not talking about what is happening on the ground. The parliament is being told what to discuss. It is only one man that thinks for the whole country. We want to start thinking for ourselves and we want to get involved in the decision making. So this is not a campaign, this is a movement to get people to use their brain and think.
The ruling party has come to congratulate you. Main opposition leader Chisabeseje, who happens to be your friend, has also come to congratulate you. What does this mean for you and your people?
This means that people power is stronger than people in power. This means that even the politicians are realizing that they have to realign. They have to start afresh and rearrange. It means they have to start listening to the voice of the people. It means they have to take will go back on the table and decide before they are kicked out.
When you are sworn in and go to parliament, what do you want to achieve? Because you will be one among small minority and NRM's majority would hold sway. What do you want to do there?
You see, when Jesus came, he was on his own, and the whole administration was the Pharisees. I want to preach to them. I want to convert not only the voters, but even the leaders. I want to convert not only the population, but the members of parliament, to make them realize that they must change their message. They must change their style of leadership and make it people-centered.
What should your constituency members, those who voted overwhelmingly for you, expect from Bobi Wine?
Well, they expect representation, physical, actual, honest and aggressive representation. But most importantly, I want to bridge the gap between the parliament and the people to make them know that parliament is just a meeting where you send a representative to decide for you. I want to make parliament easy and simple for the people to understand.
Some people are saying that you will not be taken seriously in parliament. What do you say to that?
Well, that is a stereotype. Who tells you they don't take me serious? I don't care if the politicians take me serious. For as long as the people take me serious, that's what matters. My relationship is with the people.
So what happens to your musical career as a new to be sworn in parliamentarian?
Music is not just a career to me. It's a vehicle through which I convey my messages, and I still do my music. The same way a lawyer would still do his job and a doctor would do his job. Leadership is not a job. Leadership is a responsibility, and it is part-time. And in any case, there are two people. There's Bobi Wine and there's Kyagulanyi Ssentamu.
What would be your message to your people?
My people, the most important message to them is, now you know your power. Now you know you're stronger than the guns and the soldiers. Now you know that if you come together, you can achieve whatever you want. Now you know that you are the bosses. Don't give up on that. Keep going. Now that you managed to change Chadondo, we can change Uganda for God and my country.
Robert Ssentamu is a popular Ugandan musician who just won a parliamentary election. He spoke with me from Kasangati. Meanwhile, hepatitis B is spreading in parts of northern Uganda and the country's West Nile region. Authorities link the problem in part to the influx of South Sudanese refugees. Area officials say the number of people coming into Uganda needing treatment, including vaccinations, consume a large part of the nation's health budget. For VOA, Catherine Nambi has the story from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
A majority of South Sudanese fleeing violence in their country head towards Uganda's West Nile region, which is reporting an increase in hepatitis B infections. According to health officials, many arriving South Sudanese are infected, while others have not yet been immunized. Apenyo Kennedy is a medical clinical officer at Paglinya Health Center 2 in Paglinya Refugee Settlement in the West Nile region, near the border with South Sudan. He says the number of people that test positive to the disease during screening is increasing.
When we test, like, let's say if it's 50, out of the 50 we can get 3 or 4 positive. I would say the rate of positivity is high. Before the influx of South Sudanese, it was a bit low, but when the South Sudanese came in, the rate actually become high. And as I talk now, the rate is actually higher.
To control the disease, diagnosis and vaccination have been heightened in the settlements, but according to Taco Steven, a medical clinical officer at Maji 3 Health Center in Maji Refugee Settlement, the number of those who show up for the services is overwhelming.
Every Tuesday, we carry out general vaccination of people who turn negative against hepatitis B. On average, it's 70. Particularly this week, we have vaccinated 74. So it ranges from 60 to 80. And then for those who turn positive, we register them and then we give them an appointment of 6 months. So after 6 months, they come for retest. So again, if they turn positive, that is when we refer them for liver function test as the protocol requires.
Titus Jogo is a refugee desk officer in the Adjumani district of West Nile region. He says the influx of refugees has worsened the already high burden of hepatitis B in West Nile and northern Uganda regions.
We have cases of hepatitis B, which is bigger in the refugee population as compared to Adjumani. Adjumani is the West Nile region, and the West Nile region and the great northern Uganda, hepatitis B is a problem. But Again, it has been made worse by the number of refugees who have come infected by that problem.
Northern Uganda records the second highest hepatitis B rates at 21.7%, while the West Nile region comes third with 18.5% of the total Ugandan hepatitis B prevalence. It is transmitted through contact with someone carrying the virus, including during sex or from mother to child during birth. It can also be transmitted by contaminated needles during injection. Symptoms include vomiting, yellowish skin, fatigue, and abdominal pain. Jogo says the Ugandan government is shouldering a huge burden of vaccinating and treating the refugees.
We receive most of these children and pregnant mother women who have not yet been vaccinated and immunized. And as you were aware, this vaccine is the government plan is for a particular population at a particular time. But with the continuous influx, we've got to incur more expenses on procurement of additional vaccines for vaccination and the immunization.
It is estimated that at least 3.5 million people are living with hepatitis B in Uganda, accounting for 10% of the population. In 2010, the decision-making body of the World Health Organization recognized viral hepatitis as a global public health problem and the need for governments to take action to prevent, diagnose, and treat the illness. WHO works with governments and NGOs to develop and implement strategies to prevent the spread of the disease. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA Africa News in Kampala.
A journalist with the state broadcaster Cameroonian Radio Television has been sanctioned for presenting fake news gotten from social media. As part of punitive actions taken against her, Adele Mbala was removed as director of TV information at the state broadcaster. She had read names of ministers and other officials presumed to have been named into a government of France's new president Emmanuel Macron. Her sanction came following a meeting of the board of directors of the Cameroon Radio and Television. For more, I reach Walter Wilson Nana, a journalist with Media Afrique Radio in Boya, the capital of the southwest region of Cameroon.
Mrs. Adele Mbala Atangana, who has been a long-time journalist with the Cameroon Radio and Television, she was recently appointed director of information after having gone through the ranks of the corporation. She's also one of the finest newscasters we've had on television for many years in Cameroon. And so this, I don't know how I'll put it, unfortunate day, while she was on the air on national television, I mean, a collaborator brought in a script, slipped into her hands, and it was in the heart of the French elections, in which the report we got after was that it was the presentation of the French government after the election of President Emmanuel Macron.
I understand the news broadcast did not go down well with the French embassy in Cameroon, and officials of the embassy expressed their displeasure to the foreign ministry. Tell me about this.
Yes. Thereafter that broadcast from the Cameroon Radio and Television, the television department, the French embassy expressed surprise with that information coming in from the Cameroon television. And so the French embassy wrote an official memo to the Cameroon Ministry of Foreign Affairs complaining that is it Cameroon Radio and Television that is now making public the government of the French people, because according to them, the president-elect Emmanuel Macron has not made public his government. So they were surprised to hear from Cameroon television that the government has been formed and already announced in France. And so they were asking the government of Cameroon, through the Ministry of Communication, through Cameroon Radio, Television and Radio, to give them insight of where they got that information.
Was an investigation conducted to determine what the problem was and who is to blame for this mishap?
As a journalist in Cameroon, and as an observer of national issues in Cameroon, I wouldn't put my finger officially that an investigation was going on. An investigation has been going on, ordered by the general manager of the Cameroon Radio and Television, on where that information came from. Who provided the information to the presenter of the news? Was it the editor-in-chief? Was he aware of that information? I mean, why was he giving it to her while she was on the air? So a lot of questions have been coming up along the line of where that information came from. Was it somebody who wanted to put her into a tight corner? Was it a banana peeling put on her way? So all these conjectures have been on the air.
How has been the reaction of Cameroonians following this episode of fake news?
This issue has been a big issue on the news and other media houses in Cameroon. It's been a big debate in major talk shows on private television stations in Cameroon. And the newspapers have been talking about it. Radio stations have been talking about it. Television stations in Cameroon have been talking about it. How will the director of information fall into this kind of a professional gaffe, of a professional mishap? Was it collaborators, the collaborator who brought the information to her? Did he or she get it from the internet? And if he or she got it from the internet, how credible is the internet? How credible is that website? How credible is the information? Was it coming from the website of the French presidency? Was it coming from the website of Emmanuel Macron? So those are the debates, those are the discussions which Cameroonian media men and women have been raising in the country now. Can we rely on the internet? Can we not rely on the internet? Was it really the truth? So those are the debates which are still very much in the air, especially with her recent dismissal from that position.
Walter Wilson Nana is a Cameroonian journalist with Media Afrique Radio. He spoke with me from Boya. A measles outbreak in Minnesota won't be officially over until the end of July at the very earliest. VOA's Carol Pearson reports the outbreak proves at least one thing, that the measles vaccine is effective.
No one knows who brought the measles virus to Minnesota, since it no longer occurs naturally in the U.S., but Patsy Stinchfield has worked to stop it. Stinchfield is an infectious disease nurse practitioner at Children's Minnesota Hospital. She spoke to VOA by Skype.
Measles is just such a highly contagious disease. All you have to do is be in the same room with someone who's breathing it.
78 Minnesotans have gotten the measles so far, although close to 9,000 people were exposed to the virus.
Most of those exposed were vaccinated. It tells us that the vaccine works really, really well.
Stinchfield said nurses wore face masks and met people at the doors of the hospital emergency room and at clinics to reduce exposure. Patients also had to do the same. There is no treatment for measles, only for its symptoms. Stinchfield and other health workers also met with Somali Americans, since the outbreak was almost exclusively in this community. Somali Americans had stopped vaccinating their children against measles after anti-vaccination groups told them the vaccine could cause autism, a myth that has been debunked.
They did not think that measles would be in the United States, and so the level of fear was greater for autism. That has now shifted, that the level of fear for measles is great because these families know measles. They've had loved ones die of measles in Somalia.
Stinchfield blames the outbreak on this group.
I would say almost exclusively the whole responsibility lands on the anti-vaccine movement. And the reason is misinformation and myths spread about a link between MMR and autism, which there is none, and science has proven that not to be true.
Members of anti-vaccine groups say that vaccines expose their children to health risks and can cause harm. Oddly enough, the risk for neurological problems is higher for those who choose not to vaccinate against measles than for those who do. That's because measles can cause neurological problems. Stinchfield says anything that can cause neurological damage should be avoided, and that the risks of a bad outcome from the vaccine is much smaller than the risk of having a bad outcome from measles. She cites data that shows that 1 in 1,000 cases of measles can result in encephalitis, a swelling of the brain that can cause permanent brain damage, whereas 1 in 1 million doses of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine can result in a serious allergic reaction. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with boxing. Australian Jeff Horn won a bloody and brutal fight in Brisbane, scoring a unanimous decision victory over Manny Pacquiao on Sunday. In front of a packed hometown crowd at Suncorp Stadium, Horn put up an incredible performance to claim Pacquiao's WBO welterweight championship. Horn immediately called out Floyd Mayweather Jr. after the fight, but a rematch with Pacquiao later in the year, most likely at Etihad Stadium in Melbourne, looks a near certainty after one of the biggest boxing upsets in recent memory. The defeat is Pacquiao's first since losing to Mayweather in their 2015 clash in Las Vegas, taking his career record to 59 wins with 7 losses and 2 draws, with 38 wins coming by way of knockouts. And in African football, holders Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa secured their place in the quarterfinals of the African Champions League on Saturday, along with Tunisia's sides Esperance and Etoile du Sahel. Mamelodi Sundowns were 1-0 winners away to St. George of Ethiopia in Group C, courtesy of a late strike from Liberia international Anthony Lofa, in a match where Uganda's national goalkeeper Dennis Onyango also saved a penalty for the reigning champions. Esperance then drew 2-2 away to DR Congo's AS Vita Club to advance along with Sundowns from Group C. In an eventful game, Taha Yasine Kenisi gave Esperance an early lead before Etade Etakiyama Ajite Bress then put Vita Club 2-1 up. The host suffered a big blow after Makwekwe Cooper was sent off, leaving Kenisa to hit an equalizer for Esperance from the penalty spot to secure their qualification. Esperance lead Group C on 9 points, with Mamelodi Sundowns a further point back. St. George are 3 points further adrift, but because of their head-to-head record, they would not be able to overtake the defending champions in the last round of matches. Also on Saturday, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel booked their place in the last 8 from Group A, with a 1-1 draw away to Ferroviario Beira in Mozambique. The Tunisians are 2 points clear at the top of Group A after El Merrikh beat rivals Al Hilal 2-1 in the Sudan derby on Friday night. Elsewhere on Saturday, Zambia side Zanaco missed out on qualification after being held to a goalless draw at home in Group D by record 8-times winners Al Ahly of Egypt. Morocco's Wydad Casablanca hold themselves back into contention in the group with a 2-0 win away to Cameroon's Cotton Sport Garoua in the later game. Wydad are now 2 points adrift of group leader Zanaco, with Ahly a further point back. Group B remains tight after the top two, Al Ahly Tripoli and USM Alger, drew 1-1 on Friday night. They are both on 8 points, 3 points ahead of Zamalek, who travel to Caps United on Sunday. Only the top two teams from each of the four groups will qualify for the quarterfinals in this year's African Champions League. Meanwhile, in the African Confederation Cup, Al Hilal Obeid of Sudan reached the quarterfinals on Saturday after a 2-0 home win over Recreative Libolo of Angola. In the other Group C match, Zesco United of Zambia drew 1-1 with Smoha in Egypt. With just one round of group matches remaining, Hilal have 10 points, 3 ahead of Zesco, with Libolo a further point back and Samoha on 5 points. Mamelodi Alger of Algeria also reached the last 8 of the Confederation Cup with a 2-0 home win over Platinum Stars of South Africa on Friday. Record 3 times African Confederation Cup winners CS Sfaxien of Tunisia or Mbabane Swallows of Swaziland who meet on Sunday will be the other Group B qualifiers. In Group D, Haroya of Guinea and SuperSport United of South Africa drew 0-0 in Conakry. Haroya lead the group with 9 points, SuperSport have 7, and Confederation Cup holders TP Mazembe of DR Congo are on 6 points, but could go level with Haroya with a win away to Monana of Gabon in Libreville on Sunday. Finally, the president of the Tanzanian Football Federation, TFF, Jamal Malinzi, has been arrested by the country's Prevention and Combating of Corruption Bureau. He was detained along with the TFF's Secretary General Celestine Mwesigwa. Bureau spokesman Musa Masalaba said the pair will stay in custody until further notice as they are questioned. He said the Bureau is continuing to investigate other federation officials over similar allegations. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. It's killing them all, of course. It's killing them all, of course. Make we scatter this place tonight. Dance and sweat till life's in a fight. We must settle this thing tonight, yeah. Come let us catch some feelings for night, yeah. And if you tell me, say make a of you where I get to go from. Baby, I wanna go to you.
Twitter, for Instagram, Amaka. You find or you don't find no idea matcha. But for reality, I see you care, you badam. Now we did deceive you. Gene young woman, Imani Maka. If you see the devil, Mono, the person, I chaka. Because it can be easy and we kadaka. Now we did deceive you. Shake you, where they waste you. As you there for Twitter, your name for Insta, sexy food, delicious twister. Hey, why you too the shy? Yeah, when you know, say you find you. Don't be like you. Shopping, take a selfie, tag up, tag up. You post them up, they tag your maga, tag up, tag up. You day they form me, go ye when you day in Baja. Now we did deceive you. Hey, hey, hey. You see G-Wagon, tag up. You day big mansion, tag up. Even for toilets, the room, tag up. Snapchatting video, tag up.
I'm a witness to a better life, and you say, yeah, out of mind.
know you don't feel you have a reason to shine. You're giving up because of what you're going through. There's no better way to explain to you than to tell you the world has a place for you. I know you're a star and you were meant to tell all your neighbors and your friends too. Don't take long, listen to the song. Spread love to another, you can't go wrong.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN and the Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. We are living at a time of political discourse when it would be unwise to rely heavily on statements and assertions by spokespersons of heads of state and government. Not only because one has to be cautious, but because these days we hear so much about fake news and alternate truths. But we may have no other alternative but to take seriously the statement made by the Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, last week. As the Democratic Republic of the Congo celebrated its 57th anniversary of independence, he was asked whether President Joseph Kabila would make a statement to the people of the DRC. The minister disclosed that President Kabila was sick with fever after an arduous road journey. He was then asked about the date for the presidential election this year, and the minister was a little agitated, saying that this matter was left to the Electoral Commission, but then gave some good news. He said the government had provided the commission with funding and that the Electoral Commission had already registered 30 million DRC voters with a balance of 12,042,000 in the total. This means that the issue which plagued last year's election, when the commission said it did not have enough funds to conduct election, that led to no election and President Kabila continuing in office, may be over. But in light of the New Year's agreement that was brokered by the Catholic Church, it is incumbent on the international community through the African Union or the Security Council to put certain questions and issues before the Electoral Commission. Firstly, the Electoral Commission must confirm that it has received funding from the government to conduct election this year. Secondly, it must also acknowledge that it has begun the process of registration and that the registration process will be completed in time for elections to be held this year. Furthermore, the Electoral Commission must state the date of the presidential election this year. This could be a little bit tricky. We may recall that in Sierra Leone, the Electoral Commission was the body that must declare the date for the presidential election. But for cost-cutting purposes, the commission waited until the president had declared the date for parliamentary and local election, which was March next year, and then the commission set the date for the presidential election in March 2018. It was a controversial thing with the opposition, but thankfully all the stakeholders have now agreed that the Sierra Leone presidential election should take place March 2018. With regards to DRC, the Electoral Commission must also provide a clear timetable which have been worked out with all the stakeholders in the DRC. The Electoral Commission must also affirm that in accordance with the New Year's Eve agreement, President Joseph Kabila would not be on the ballot. And this may be a little difficult because President Kabila had not signed that agreement, although his party did sign it. But this has to go on record. These procedures are necessary because, as has been said over and over again, failure to hold elections this year in the DRC may result in bloodshed. Furthermore, the international community must ensure that by holding President Kabila to the date for election this year, we reduce the chances of incumbent presidents manipulating electoral commissions to go beyond the constitutional time limit in power. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, old men sit in the shade because they planted a tree many years before. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights monitors are deploring the continuing crackdown on freedom of expression in Iran. The Center for Human Rights in Iran reports that formerly imprisoned photojournalist Asal Esmoilzadeh was suddenly arrested without charge on June 19th when she accompanied her husband Saeed Saif to the Culture and Media Court in Tehran. Saif is editor-in-chief of the Didban news website, where Esmoilzadeh works as well. Both husband and wife were volunteers on President Hassan Rouhani's media team during the recent presidential campaign. The press freedom organization Reporters Without Borders also reported on Esmoilzadeh's arrest. Saif tweeted that his wife was arrested to put pressure on him to make false statements about President Rouhani and ministers in his government. Reporters Without Borders also condemned the overall increase in internet censorship and harassment of citizen journalists in Iran. According to its tally, 94 internet users, mainly users of the instant messaging service Telegram, and 12 journalists remain in prison since the start of 2017. In most cases, journalists and citizen journalists arrested by the regime are charged with immoral acts or cybercrimes. This includes three citizen journalists arrested last year for content they had posted on Telegram. In April, Mohammad Mohajer, Alireza Tavakoli, and Mohammad Mehdi Zamanzadeh were given a 12-year sentence for insulting Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and the Islamic Republic's founder, Ruhollah Khomeini. In addition, some 173,000 Telegram accounts have been blocked by the government under the guise of protecting the public from immoral content. The U.S. believes that freedom of expression is a fundamental human right and that a free press is a key component of democratic governance. Through sanctions and other means, including by shining a spotlight on the Iranian government's human rights abuses, the United States, as acting U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Virginia Bennett has said, will continue to apply pressure on Iran to protect the human rights and fundamental freedoms of the Iranian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.